My name is Chris Jensen. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, I have not found it necessary to have a drink since July 12, 1995, and for that I am grateful. You know, I came in tonight, and I'm looking out on all these folks, and I'm sort of amazed. We sometimes take things for granted in AA. I'm looking out here and see all these folks who have recovered from a seemingly helpless state of mind and body, these alcoholics who are sober, and it's a Saturday night. I mean, that's an amazing thing. It's a miracle, and we would live through that all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank David for inviting me to speak. It's a privilege and it's an honor to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's truly humbling to be asked to do something like this. I don't know about you, but frequently in AA, I'm asked to do things I feel uncomfortable about. I worry that I can't do them perfectly, but what I found is that God really needs yes men and yes women. When we're asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was taught when I was coming up that the answer is yes, unless you have a conflict. And it's got to be a pretty major conflict for my sponsor, let me tell you. And when you do those things, great things just happen. You know, when you agree to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, great things just happen, just like the big book promises they will. And so I would encourage you to say yes when somebody asks you to volunteer. David asked me in March to speak. I asked him, well, do you have any suggestions? He said, well, just don't think about it. March, April, May. Now, can an alcoholic, you know, not think about something when told not to think about it? Not really. And if I had been able to not think about it, I think I probably wouldn't be an alcoholic. So it's been a little bit of obsession in my mind. I commute into Atlanta, 30 miles in, 30 miles back from Gwinnett County, and I've given this talk to you all maybe 50, 60 times. And I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. But the neat thing is after 9 o'clock tonight, I can have another obsession bite the dust. You know, we all have our obsessions, and we carry them into sobriety. I am the DCM for six... I wanted to mention my home group, Progress Not Perfection. It's up in Gwinnett County. It's been my home group since I first came in. We have open meetings, open on Sunday night, with discussion based on the big on literature, and a big book study on Wednesday nights that it takes about a year to get through the first 164 pages. It actually started out, the reason it's an open meeting is it started out as a young person's meeting, and you know, young people frequently aren't sure whether they're alcoholics or drug addicts or whatever, and that tradition, that practice sort of discontinued. Also, I was told by some of the members, these young people who have grown up now through the years, that they wanted to be like the old-time AA and allow anybody who thought they might have a problem to come to the meeting. And the really weird thing is the meeting sort of suffered, and they were prayed for some more people to come, and instead of getting a young person, they got me. I was about 38, 39 at the time when I came in, and the meeting's going really well. It's interesting, we were talking in the DCM meeting today about contributions going down to GSO. And part of our experience in that meeting was we were always so afraid to give money because of our, that we didn't have enough money. But once we started giving money to district and to the state and to New York, we started getting more money. It was just a really odd type of a spiritual thing. So if your group isn't contributing, I'd encourage you to send in whatever you can send in, you know? You know, maybe not less than the price of the stamp, but you know, get some money together, send it in. It's always a good idea. I'm the DCM for 16D, which is up in Gwinnett County. We have great sobriety up in Gwinnett County, and we're just so lucky to have that. And I'm also editor of The Message. I chair the ad hoc committee that gave the report that led to the communications committee, and I was asked in the communications committee to mention that The Message is online if you ever want to download it. It's on the website, and the get your pencils. The username is Eric, and you can email me at editor@aageorgia.org. We've been working really to improve the message and trying to write about the sobriety experience in Georgia and not just to have it to be a Oregon telling about the official business of the assembly, but also to attract people into service. And have you all seen the changes?
Yes.
Well, let me know what you think. And I'm actually trying to solicit some experience from folks. If you get a chance, email in about your first meeting in Georgia. If you're a Yankee, you came down here and thought, they're not doing it right. Write in about that. If you're a newcomer like I was, I'm a Yankee, but I got sober down here. Our comic strip, Alcoholic, he's going through his first meeting, and I thought it'd be neat to have a little feature about others' experience in Georgia. Service is very important to me. It's important to my story. In the big book, it talks about faith without works is dead, and I really believe in that. I do a lot of talking as DCM about the service structure in Gwinnett County and how groups, and according to our literature, should be reaching out with group liaisons or reps in terms of corrections and PICPC and Grapevine and intergroup reps if you got an intergroup rep. So I would encourage you all to carry that message too. It's in the pamphlet on the group and also in our AA service manual to sort of reach out and do that kind of service work. Because in Gwinnett County, for example, when I moved there, it was still pretty rural and suburban. Through my employer, I've seen information that in the next decade, there's going to be 1 million people in Gwinnett County. So that's 50,000 to 100,000 alcoholics. So that's pretty urban at that point. And we need to think in terms of Gwinnett County and in other parts of Georgia, too, in terms of reaching out to the alcoholic, to the community. Anyway, so there's my pitch for service and for the message. My story. I was born in Davenport, Iowa. Anybody been there? Iowa? Yay, Hawkeyes, all right. Who knows the Mississippi River? It runs north and south, right? Except where I was born in Davenport. It actually goes east and west. And then back south again down to New Orleans. And the reason I mention that is my whole life was sort of like the Mississippi River, just out of kilter. I had a really great childhood, really good parents, no alcoholism in my immediate family, but outside of my immediate family, I had an uncle. He was the drunk. You know, he was the one that we had to always go bail out. He was the one who eventually my dad actually had to have committed to a state institution so he could not die. And he was my example of an alcoholic. And we have various cousins and others, too, who have this disease. I grew up going to church. For the most part, I had a really, really good childhood. In the 12 and 12, it talks about how we can have emotional conflicts that persist below the level of consciousness. And at the time of these occurrences, they actually may give our emotions violent twists, which have discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. I had that kind of an experience when I was a kid outside of my immediate family. And when you lose your innocence and you have that sort of shame and guilt that you carry with you, it's going to affect you. When you're an alcoholic, it's really going to affect you, let me tell you that. And the only reason I mention that is I know people suffer from that sort of experience in childhood. And my experience is, I remember hearing Joe and Charlie talk about this, that you don't have to be a victim. You don't have to put up with that. And through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and getting sober, and for me it took some outside help too, you can let go of the past and it can become something that will help with others. But you don't have to hold on to that anymore, and I'm glad I don't have to anymore. When I came into AA, I really identified, not just with the drinking, but also with the thinking. When you guys talked about grandiosity and being sensitive, people always tell me, you got to learn not to take things so personally. And I still do that sometimes in sobriety. You have to, the self-pitying, the all-or-nothing thinking, I really identified when you all shared about that. Another experience I wanted to mention as a young person, two more experiences. I met my wife, Karen, she's down there, and we met when we were 16. And we were married when we were 21, and if we don't die or get divorced, in August we'll be married for 30 years. And that's an amazing thing, and thank you all very much. Because when you asked me to give this kind of talk, it, for me, it made me more introspective, and we were talking a little bit about the drinking on the way back down here, and she put up with a lot when I was drinking, you know, when I was drinking at home. She was telling me how, you know, I would come home angry all the time. She knew just as soon as I started drinking, the anger would come out, and how that affected my family. And I'm just grateful. We have three kids. They all go to UGA right now. They have their problems, but because I got sober when they were all fairly young, I think I was a better dad. And if I'd have been drinking the way I was drinking through their teen years, you know, no telling where they would have ended up. The other experience I wanted to mention at an early age is I mentioned my uncle. He lived with my grandfather for a while out in McCausland, Iowa. My grandfather had a farm. And we used to go out and spend afternoons. And when I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, they all gave me a big book. And as I read it, I thought, I have read this before. Where have I read this before? And I remembered a red-covered book in McCausland, Iowa. And the parts I remember was the sex part, because I was like 10, 12, somewhere in there when I read it. And that's the part I really, really, really remembered. I thought, where have I read that? And then it came to me that either my grandfather, who during the war did some work on the East Coast, welding and that type of thing. He came from Denmark, and he served in World War I, and he went off to in the Second World War to do some welding and stuff on ships. Or my uncle picked up a big book at some point. And I wish I had that red-covered big book. That would be really cool. But it's gotten lost through the years. But I'm glad that I had that experience. And it's sort of a little foreboding there, wasn't it? My first drink, I don't remember exactly when I had, I knew what alcohol tasted like, you know, wine and beer, you know, you have, the first drink I can remember, I went to high school and I didn't drink at prom, you know, I was really a good kid, but the first drink I can remember, it was right before I was 18, and I was working for a weekly newspaper in Bettendorf, Iowa, and I got to go cover, anybody remember Buddy Rich? Great drummer, great percussionist, and he was in at the Black Hawk Hotel in Davenport, Iowa. And I had to go cover him for this weekly I was working on. And they asked me if I wanted a drink, and the drinking age was 18. I still wasn't quite 18, and I didn't know what to say. So I said, sure, I'll have a scotch. And it was fine. Honestly, it was fine. I have not really met a drink that I couldn't drink. I don't know why that is. But when I was younger, I just thought I had great tolerance. But the first kegger, I didn't go to keggers in high school even. I mean, I was going to church. I was a good kid. I had that experience I mentioned. But the first kegger I went to was at the University of Iowa. My wife and I were both in the same dorm. And I drank so much that night, and this friend of mine said, you've never been to a kegger? And I said, no. And he gave me some aspirin, and, you know, the next morning I was sick and all that sort of stuff. But I liked it. I really liked to drink. In my drinking, basically, the first 10 years, alcohol was a solution. It was something that really helped me overcome fear. As I mentioned, I worked for newspapers. I used to drink with journalists. I used to drink with cops. I used to drink with politicians at various times. And if you'd asked me back then, well, what are you doing this drinking? I said, oh, I'm developing sources. I'm being a reporter, you know? When I got sober, I looked back on it, I saw it through a different lens. You know, I remember one time, we used to drink at a bar called Looney's. It was a cop bar in Rock Island, Illinois. And Looney was actually a gangster. If you ever saw Road to Perdition on TV, it talked to the Paul Newman character, I think his name was Rooney. And they changed his name for the movie because they thought Looney was just too crazy. But Looney's was a cop bar, and I remember one time, I used to get great tips there and do stories and stuff. And one time there was a big drug bust, and I said to the guys, well, why didn't you tell me about it? And they said, we did, you know, but you were just sort of drunk, you know. And so I missed that story. But but drinking really let me hang out with adults. It made me feel a part of. It helped me overcome fears in life. I can understand why a lot of writers drink, because it really is good at overcoming fear while it's still working. When it switches on, as it did later in life, then it becomes a problem. As Karen and I were talking today on the road down, you know, we've known each other a long time, and, you know, I've seen her drunk. But she grew up, I didn't. And as she was talking, she said a really important thing. She said, I didn't like feeling out of control when I drank. And I thought, that is like the best definition of alcoholism or the non-alcoholic I can think of, because when I drank, I always felt in control. Even later, when I was drinking daily and drinking AA people, I felt in control, which was a delusion. That's what our big book says. It doesn't say denial. It's just delusion, you know. But that's the way it was. So anyway, this pattern of drinking, and it was, you know, it was fun. You know, going out to bars, hanging with guys, putting out the newspaper, going to bars. It's kind of sick when you think about it. When you're in your 20s and you have a beautiful wife at home and you're out drinking, that's kind of weird when you think about it a little bit. But that's the way it was. Anyway, I started probably in my mid-20s, late-20s, I started to fight alcohol a little bit. I could see I had a problem. Don't tell me that willpower doesn't work with alcoholism, it's at least in the early stages, because it does. I can remember going to events and wanting to drink more and just not doing it because I wanted to not drink. I didn't want to get DUI or whatever the situation. During this time, too, in my mid-20s, I remember I put on some weight, as we tend to do when we drink sometimes, and I sort of switched addictions. I remember I was at a softball league game where I was drinking a lot, and this catcher said to me, put your weight behind it, when I was up to bat. And I thought, he's so-and-so. And so I started running. And I thought, well, you know, if I really get in shape, maybe I'll be able to handle this drinking thing. And so I quit drinking. It was, a couple of years. I didn't drink at all. And I started running marathons. You know, so I went from just not running very much to running 26 miles. And that's the way we are. And that is a definition, to me at least, of switching addictions. And the running was an important part of my story, too, for a while, because I remember later on, when I started drinking again, as we tend to do who are alcoholic, that I would sometimes run. Like, I remember one time we were out to brunch and we had champagne, and I went out on a longer run, and I threw up during the run, and I ran back, and I thought to myself, wow, I'm in great shape. I can throw up and still run. You know? And if you think of that way, you may be an alcoholic. You just might be. I don't know. One of my really major character defects is ingratitude. I remember when I got sober, my sponsor would have me do gratitude lists. But I had a lot of positive things going on in my life. My ingratitude is often fear-based. It's selfishness. It's self-centeredness. And I was never satisfied with where I was at. And I was, at the time, in our late 20s, we began to have children. As we will, and I remember the battle of alcoholism going on with that. I can remember watching my daughter in my late 20s, right around 30, and I was in charge of it for that weekend, and I had like a 12-pack of beer, and I knew I couldn't get drunk, and I remember pouring that out so I would not be drunk and being in charge of a child. And Karen doesn't have to do that. You know, normal people don't have to do that, but I did. The ingratitude, though, is I was never really happy. I was living in Davenport, Iowa. My folks were there. My family was there. Her family was there. Major role on a small paper. But I always wanted to work on a big paper. You know, I thought things would be better if I just moved, you know, that I'd be more appreciated. And so the opportunity came to come to Atlanta, to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But unfortunately, in the move, one thing was kind of awry. I brought me with us, you know. And you can't escape from yourself. And meanwhile, my alcoholism was starting to get worse. And in Atlanta, guess what? I wasn't happy. You know, we're down here with three kids, and I'm not happy. And then out of the blue, I had a chance to go back to my hometown paper as features editor, and I accepted the position. But unfortunately, I got scared, and I thought it took a long time to get to a big paper, and I'd made the decision to stay here. And after that, my drinking took on a different sort of dynamic. Instead of drinking for fun, Because I was afraid of getting a DUI down here. I've never gotten a DUI. I should have gotten a DUI tons of times. When I used to go to those bars and things, the car knew its way home. You know, it was fine. But when I got down here, I did a lot of drinking at home. Not always. I can remember going to some press conferences and things where they had a bar, and having that bar was like the biggest thing in the room, and they'd have free drinks, and having to resist that, having to fight that, and then getting so drunk when I got home. And I can remember, I was feeling really squirrely in May when, you know, we won a Pulitzer Prize for Mike Lukacs for his cartoons. And I was like, why am I feeling squirrely? And then I remembered, we'd had champagne 11 years ago in the newsroom then, too, and I had too much. And I was afraid to drive home that night because I was drunk. And when they had it in the newsroom, I didn't drink any, but, you know, I just felt kind of squirrely, sort of a memory type of a thing. So anyway, I was feeling really, really happy, but I was a good employee. But like I said, I was really, at home, I was drinking a lot, and my disease was progressing. You know, I talked about the anger with Karen. If you came home, you would see, I didn't mend it very well. One time I got really angry when I'd been drinking, and I picked up a little baby rocker, and I threw it, and it left two little holes right in the drywall, you know? And that's mended now, but that's a sign that shows what kind of anger and what was going on back then in the house. And on the outside, it looked good. You know, I always had these fears that people would find out, that they would find out that I was drinking. I used to go to different gas stations, you know, so they wouldn't know how much I'm buying. I used to hide bottles around the house. And the scary thing was, when Karen would find a bottle, she's a good Al-Anon, she would just leave it out. She wouldn't. So you come home. I bought my wine by the box, and I would go back and forth trying to recover that feeling, that early drinking, that solution, and I couldn't get it back. Other memories from back then, I remember the water test. You know, it talks in the big book how we try these different things to get sober. And I remember I thought, well, I'll have one bottle of water, one beer. And of course, that test soon fell apart. It didn't work out, as they never do. And the running part sort of got worse because I started to have some health effects from my drinking, and I couldn't run as much either. And so that added even more sort of strains at home. And so, but on the outside, we looked really, really good. I was coaching soccer still at work. I was a very functional alcoholic, and nobody knew what kind of drinking problem I had because I didn't drink with people. I didn't want them to see my drinking, you know, what it was like. And but I was unhappy. I was unhappy at work. Things weren't going the way I liked. And then the worst thing that could happen to an alcoholic happened to me. I got what I wanted. I was made the first internet columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It was an idea I had. They went with it. I also got to cover consumer electronics, and that was in the fall of 94. And within a year, I'd be in treatment. Because what they didn't know is I actually hadn't quite gotten what I wanted, but I'd gotten pretty darn close. And I thought about my former boss. I thought, I'll show her. I'll quit drinking, and I'll become the best reporter this paper's ever seen. And they didn't even know I was drinking. But that's the kind of thinking that I had going on. At this time, too, my drinking, I began having suicidal thoughts. I thought that was just awful because I'd gone to church all my life. During all this time, we're going to church, doing all the good things. I'm a deacon. I have served communion hungover so many times, guys. You know? Honest to God. You know? But I just didn't have that kind of spiritual connection that we talk about in these rooms. And so I got this job. My picture was in the paper every Sunday with a column. And it got worse. The drinking became really daily. I can remember just, you know, showing up to work late, drinking into the wee hours. I was sort of a cyber drunk. We weren't hooked up to the internet at work yet, but I was at home. And I would get on the internet to find material for my column, and I would sort of just pass out in my rocker, or on this couch that we had in there. And that's the way it was. And at work, I started having problems. I was also covering consumer electronics, and I was keeping things that didn't belong to me. manufacturers who would send me like VCRs and things to write about, and I wasn't sitting in back because I was doing all this drinking and trying to do all these other things, and I just couldn't manage anymore. And it was almost like I remember feeling like I was just in a free fall. You know, like in those movies where the guys are turning around, you know. I identify with that. That's how I felt that last year. And I remember Karen would come by sometimes, and I would have whatever I was drinking, because I went back and forth to Johnny Walker Red, different kinds of beers, wine, you know, just whatever. And thinking, you know, she wanted a drink or something, you know, cause, you know, you don't want to share. But also thinking, don't follow me to this place. And in my brain, a lot of times my prayer when I was, God, just don't let me wake up the next day. And it takes a long time to drink, you know, to drink yourself to death. It really does. But I was starting to like bleed in places you're not supposed to bleed, and having different sort of symptoms of alcoholism. I would go to this Chinese restaurant downtown alone, and after I got to work, usually late. And he would have two tall boys just sitting on my tray every time. And I was just trying to survive, trying to get through. I remember my sons were little then, and they'd wake me up at like 7:30 in the morning. Bye, Dad. I'll see you later. And I look over at the alarm clock, and it'd be noon or 1, and I was late again to work. And I would have to explain to my boss. And, you know, it was not a happy time. And finally at work, they begin to call me on this, because you can't be drinking this much and working for a major newspaper without starting to make really bad mistakes. And I was making really bad mistakes and very angry and very closed. And finally, they put me on probation for 3 months. And I was stuck, because I knew I couldn't stop drinking. I remember during that last year thinking, you're just becoming like your uncle. I thought, no, but I'm handling it. I thought, I'm handling it. So I knew I couldn't stop drinking, but I knew I couldn't fulfill the probation without stopping drinking. And I was, at that point, you know, it talks about in the big book, I was stuck. I had no place to really go. So I turned myself in. I went to the managing editor, who did me a great service. I went to him and said, what would you say if I had a drinking problem? I think it was something like that. And he said, we can fix that. And it was right before Memorial Day, and the next Tuesday, it was a week before, and the next Tuesday I found myself in treatment. And that began a journey. It began a journey for me. And the thing I remember, the first thing I remember in treatment, there was a nurse named Florence there. And Florence said to me, Chris, recovery is all about surrender. She was Southern, and she was a lovely lady. And it was just like she just took a dagger and went right into my soul. Because I'd gone to church all my life, and in the other big book, it talks about how you can't serve two masters. You know, that you'll hate one and not, you know. And in our big book, on page 53, this used to be my favorite passage. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. He either is, God either is, or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And up to that point, I had used God, as it talks about in 12:12, just pretty much as a pitch hitter. You know, I would ask things from God. And you know, the simplest way to put it is I was using God as my co-pilot. You know, he's somebody I would go to when I was in trouble. And if God's your co-pilot, the wrong person is flying the plane, you know? That's just the way it is. That's just the way it goes. And I knew that I had not surrendered, as Florence said, my life to God as I understood him. And I was scared, you know, because I couldn't figure out how this happened, because I'd always been a good kid, and I was responsible, and we were raising our kids and all that sort of thing. And so when I went to treatment, the best thing they did was they said to go to AA. They go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so they sent me off to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began a journey of sobriety. It wasn't perfect. I had a slip July 11th. And you may notice my sobriety is July 12th. And this is where a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing for a newcomer. I got up one morning. You all said to get rid of the mouthwash in the house. I remember you guys telling me that. And I didn't. I'll never drink that. And I got up in the morning and started drinking the mouthwash in the house on July 11th. And the reason I did that, this is really alcoholic thinking, was I thought, you know, if I drink this and the phenomenon of craving begins from drinking mouthwash, it's not my fault if I get drunk. And I didn't, it was stupid, but that's really alcoholic thinking. And needless to say, I picked up another white chip, and what it taught me a lot, that experience, was about honesty and realizing that I have a fatal disease. I came in and began, you know, going to my home group, Progress Not Perfection. You know, you all said to do 90 meetings in 90 days, and I was scared to death. I probably did over 200. At work, they were really, really good about that. I would go to meetings in the, like in the morning before I went into work. I would go to meetings at the afternoon lunch meetings. I would go to meetings in Gwinnett County when I got out there. And I just felt safe there, and I started to identify, and I started to read the big book, and I got sponsorship, and we started going through the steps. And, you know, step one was really, you know, I'd already taken it, and I've grown an understanding in step one as time has gone on, and I may talk about that a little bit later. But I remember my sponsor at the time had me do just a list of ways that my life had become unmanageable, sort of a drinking history. And I was glad to have that because later in my disease, it kept telling me, it really wasn't that bad. And I could look at that list, that drinking history, as part of that, doing that first step for me anyway. And that helped. It also helped to have Karen because I could say, did I really drink that much? And she'd say, yes, you did. You know, so it's good to have a wife in that situation. The second step, I had some teachers about the fatal nature of the disease in my first year. One name was Thomas C., and I remember an early meeting at Progress Not Perfection, and we talked about insanity. And he said, Chris, you got to realize he used the F word, you're effing insane. And for some reason, I thought that was so funny. I hadn't laughed for months. And I began to understand the insanity of the disease and how it would take a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience to overcome it. And he also helped me see the thoughts I was having about suicide. I had this dilemma. I couldn't commit suicide and be found out because then the family wouldn't get the insurance money. You know? And so I thought, well, the way to do it is, you know, I commuted. You just wait for a truck to pull over. And then when it hits me, you know, I would die, and you know, they'd get the money. I'd be like, you know, death of a salesman or something, and they would get the money, and I would have done the right thing, you know. The problem is when trucks pull over those big semis, your survival instinct kicks in. You pull over. But those are the kind of debates I used to have in my head back then, and therefore I don't have to have them anymore. Thomas, who almost became my sponsor, allegedly had 19 years sober and clean. One day he called, and I was early in sobriety, I didn't know better, and I couldn't return the call to him. And they found him dead in Marietta with a needle in his arm. And he taught me about the fatal nature of the disease. And that was a strong teacher. You know, sometimes the folks who don't make it are our strongest teacher. The other people who taught me about honesty in relation to the first step were Charles and Suzanne. They were in treatment with me. Charles was like inpatient for a while, and Suzanne would be inpatient for a while because they had a rule that they couldn't. I went to West Paces Hospital Options, and they had a rule that you couldn't have married couples on the same floor. It was just a rule. And I remember Suzanne said in one of our groups, if I drink again, I will die. And she was exactly right. When I got out of treatment, she drank again, and I got to go to her funeral, and I got to see how fatal this disease is. And they were good Baptists, and they had taught Sunday school. And I remember in treatment, they shared how they were professional people. They had gone to Betty Ford, and they had gone to Hazleton, and they had gone to New York, and they had gone to Phoenix, and they would drink on the plane on the way home. And Charles could quote the big book verbatim. And I later found out he never picked up a white chip. That was amazing. And they taught me about honesty, because it talks about how there are some people who just can't get this thing in our book. And they taught me about that. And I being new in my first year tried to 12-step Charles. And one of my counselors said, you do not go near that man. your sobriety is not as powerful as his alcoholism. You know, she just ordered me off. And I hadn't heard from him since. But they taught me a lot about the fatal nature of the disease, and we're supposed to emphasize that. That's something that's in the big book. We're supposed to talk about that. So the second step, third step I took with my sponsor on my knees at Progress Not Perfection, and then I began the fourth and fifth step. The fourth and fifth step, we did it at the Waffle House. The first time I did it, he did it so cool. He would send me home, and I figured this out. As a writer, I find for me it's better to do what it says in the big book. You just do a list, you know. And I figured out the grid later. I got Joe and Charlie's, you know, grid, and that sort of works for me too. But I try to keep it simple. And I went off and did my resentments, and then after a week or so, I'd come back to the Waffle House, and I'd go through them all with him, and we'd talk about it. And then he said, okay, now go off and do your fears. And after a week or so, I came back and did that. And then he said, okay, go off and do the sex stuff and the other stuff that don't quite fit in. And I came back and did that. And he said, did you leave anything out? You know, then this took place over a couple months, you know. I said, no. He said, congratulations, you've just done your fifth step. And that's how I did it the first time. And it was so painless because, you know, in terms of hours, it probably was 6 hours total. But it wasn't all at once. And he shared his experiences. And the interesting thing about the fifth step, too, for me, was early in sobriety, very early, I had what I call a fifth step experience I share about, but some of that childhood stuff that I mentioned earlier, don't do this. The steps are in order for a reason, but I shared it. And it was just with a guy, and he had the same damn experience. And it was amazing, but it just was like ripping open a wound that didn't need to be ripped open at that time. And I was pretty shaky for a week or so after that, you know. But I got through it. But you know, and the reason I shared that was I remember treatment, they kept saying, you're only as sick as your secret. But this is the biggest secret I've got. And, you know, it came out. And I talked about it here. So that's no secret anymore. I had some trouble with the six and seven steps. I didn't quite get it. And my experience is that our defects really don't quite ever go away. I've had old timers say they have the same defects. But I love in the seven-step prayer where it talks about ask God to remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. That really works for me because even though many of my defects are still around, when I ask God to remove them, then I'm able to serve God at that moment. And I've known people with 40 years sobriety who say they still have defects of character. So apparently they don't go away, and I think that's just a human experience, but anyway, the sixth and seventh step, I really love those steps. Eight and nine, went back to that list in the Waffle House, and he made me own my stuff, because, you know, I was sort of a type person, and he said, you know, well, what did you do to harm that person? And before I could make amends, he made me go through with him what I was going to say. And I remember, you know, it talks about how halfway through you're going to be amazed, you know, when you do the promises and when you do amends. And one was to a former boss. And at the end of it, she said, and I didn't talk about her part, but just my part, and at the end of it, she said, you did really good. You can go back to your sponsor and tell him what a good job you did. And the interesting thing about that, she obviously had amends made to her before, but he said that within a few months of that, I returned to features, where I had left to get the job that, you know, I really wanted. And I've been there 10 years. And that boss has moved on. She's retired. But that's, to me, the amazing thing is that I return back to a place where I feel comfortable. 10, daily inventory. 11 and 12 and 12, where it talks about restraint of pen and tongue. I think if Bill was alive today, he would add, and email. You know? I remember when I was drinking, I would frequently send emails that I had no business sending. 11, prayer is very important. I try to keep it simple. I like what Chuck C. talks about. If you've ever heard the new pair of glasses, just for me, just keeping it as simple as possible and having a daily conversation with God seems to work. And service. For the 12th step, I find carrying the message very fulfilling. I like what Dr. Bob talks about, how it's a duty. and it's something that I know I can do a better job at. I find practicing principles in all our affairs, the hardest place for me to still practice it is at work. I get disappointed sometimes, and but as long as I focus on gratitude, it seems like things are going to be okay. So I got sober, and life is perfect. Nah. We really have a program for living. That's what it boils down to, without drinking. It's like I talked about at the beginning. It's amazing to see this many drunks sober on a Saturday night. And we've had challenges. I've had my challenges through my sobriety, but I haven't had a drink over them, and that's amazing, and that's a miracle. I remember one thing I'm sort of ashamed of is I talked earlier about how faith without works is dead and how much I enjoy service, but in 2001 I sort of got angry at God. He and I had a falling out. And I was the alternate DCM at the time in our district, and I just quit going to meetings. And I didn't drink, and I was still going to church. I'm an elder at our church, and it was just weird. It was a few months. I quit going to even my home group, and it didn't work. That doesn't work, because God is going to have, for me, God is going to have his way. I always think of Jonah and the well, that if you get on a boat and you head off the opposite way, you're going to get thrown off the boat, God's going to send a fish, and he's going to take it to Nineveh anyway. That's the way it kind of works for me. And God only wants the best for me, and so by doing that, I'm grateful, because I found out that it didn't work. I've known people who have many years sobriety who went much longer than that. And when I came back to my home group, after a while, it wasn't that long, they made me GSR. And so I went to district, and our alternate had to leave. His job changed, and they made me alternate DCM. And, of course, now I'm in my second year as DCM. And my penance was, one of the duties of the alternate DCM is to plan our unity weekend in Gwinnett County. And I got to plan two of them as an alternate DCM. So anyway, but it helped me to be humble, too, because sometimes, I don't know if you ever do this, but sometimes people don't fulfill their commitments in AA. And by doing that, I can look at myself and say, yeah, but you didn't either. You didn't either. But for the grace of God, you can do that. And again, when I came back fully into the program, and great things started happening again, Dick invited me to work on the ad hoc committee. Editing the message has just been a great honor and a privilege. And just working with alcoholics in this way is just incredible. So that's sort of the program part. We've had issues in living. The childhood stuff, spent some time in counseling for that. Like a lot of alcoholics, I've suffered from depression. I found that if I keep myself spiritually fit, and I've been working on my weight and my fitness too, that seems to work better than other alternatives in my sobriety. I also love really reading what Bill wrote about depression, because that guy, he was so depressed. You read about him, and he talks about walking and just going out and doing stuff. Just doing the work. And that's just such an example to me. A big challenge in sobriety has been balance with family and program. I remember my first Atlanta roundup, there was an old timer there, and she talked about how she had to make amends to her son because she had spent so much time with the program when he was young that he had a resentment towards AA. And so I recognized early on from watching you guys that I had to give as much to my family as I give to the newcomer. I got to raise the mic up a little bit. As I do to the newcomer. And so that balance with family and program is important. That first year, though, for me, it was important that I get to as many meetings as possible and work with the steps. And it paid off later in life, is what I found out. As I mentioned, sometimes I have problems with work. Working the program, I find when I go there, like Chuck C. does, to do it for fun and for free, and I remember God's my employer, things seem to go a lot smoother than if I go there being selfish and self-centered. We've had some issues with finances, but God's always provided what we needed to pay for whatever we need. Sometimes we don't get what we want, but you know. And a couple of years ago, we had a really sort of a double emotional whammy. My father died, and my daughter got married about 2 months after that. And taking a daughter getting married is just sort of an emotional thing for a dad anyway. And she wanted to have a champagne toast, and so we had apple juice, you know, for us non-imbibers. And I think we had more bottles of apple juice that we used up than the champagne. It was kind of interesting. The death of my father was obviously traumatic. I remember the first person, this is like 2 years ago, May, too, and I talked to was my sponsor. And I got to go through that as a good son. And it was on a Monday, and in Davenport, Iowa. And I fulfilled those obligations as good as I could. I got to talk with my uncle, who's been sober 15 years in the program. He had his chip. And share and see people I hadn't seen in a long time and be as good a son as I could be and as good a father to my children, too. And I remember one of the things that really saved me was when I went back to Iowa on trips, I'd gone to meetings there. I'd started that in my early years in sobriety, and I had a group to go there, you know, that I could actually, by that Friday, I got to finally go to a meeting, and I could start grieving in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for that. So, my favorite part of the big book right now is page 61 of the big book, where it talks about the actor. We all know the part about the actor. But this sentence has really gotten me the last year or two. That is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? And I look at that, and that's my sort of credo, is that I frequently want to run things and manage things well, but when I let God manage things well, when I surrender, like Florence told me at the very, very beginning of my sobriety, then I can be in a good spiritual condition, I can be a vessel for God, and I can let him do his thing. Or, as it says in our 11-step prayer, for it is by self-forgetting that one finds, it is by forgiving that one is forgiven, it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. So that dying to self, for me, when that happens, the great things that it talks about in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous happen. And I think maybe that's the greatest gift that you guys have given me, is the ability to just let God do his thing and just be a part of. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.